Tape's on, Diane?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll call the meeting of the House Senate Subcommittee on Claims to Order. And we do have a quorum. Let's take care of the minutes from the last meeting.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we approve the minutes as approved from the previous meeting.
Okay, Representative Anderson's moved the minutes from Friday, March 26th. Any discussion on the minutes? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Motion approved. Okay, I think we'll just take the agenda right in order here and start with the Hines case. Senator Letts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. When we ended the last hearing, we had not reached any specific conclusions about either how to handle this case or the numbers that might be involved if we chose to give compensation. And I indicated that I would kind of have some research done and do some of my own to get some sort of a principles or some parameters around which we might base compensation if we decided to do that, and then come back here with a recommendation. And I'm prepared to make that recommendation today. The research was done by Senate counsel and by Mr. Lindeke, the reviser's office. And we pulled together, in addition to the work that Ms. Rehack from the courts had done, and we pulled together basically a list of comparable or statutes around the state, country rather, as to how these kind of claims are handled. And here's what we determined. 22 states have statutory schemes for dealing with compensation for wrongful conviction. And I emphasize the word conviction because that's the basis for those states. Those schemes range everywhere from simply reduced tuition at higher education institutions in the state to a daily amount, to wage loss, some combination of the two, and the daily amounts varied, to quote-unquote fair and reasonable compensation, which is wide open, to directing the claimant to the State Tort Claims Act, and also just nothing at all, which would include potentially special bills in the legislature when the case would arise, and so on. We found a couple of statutes that were kind of geographically consistent with Minnesota. Missouri and Iowa and Wisconsin all have statutes that deal with wrongful convictions. And it seems to me that even though this is not a wrongful conviction, this was a rightful conviction, but it was an obvious sentencing error of which there is no dispute, that the consequence and the way that a lot of the other cases are calculating it, statutes are calculating it, is based upon the fact that someone has been wrongfully incarcerated for some length of time. I would argue that there is some distinction to be made philosophically between someone who is not otherwise going to go to jail and because of a wrongful conviction ends up in jail in the first place or prison in the first place, and someone who does go to jail because they've committed a crime and been convicted of it rightfully, but end up serving more time than they otherwise would. But for purposes of this analysis, I think it's fair to treat them comparably in terms of compensation. I thought that the Iowa statute was a good reference point. And the Iowa statute provides for $50 a day of compensation for the period of wrongful incarceration without any cap, plus wage loss with a cap of $25,000. And Missouri's statute is not too far off from that. Wisconsin has a more miserly statute with, if I recall, a total cap of like $5,000. And California does $100 a day, income tax-free. Missouri and Iowa are more comparable, I think, to where Minnesota might end up. I think it's a fair reference point. A couple of thoughts on it. One is, if you think about it, $50 a day for being in jail or prison instead of at home or out and about freely is not a lot of money. It's about $2 an hour On the other hand, it's easy to understand, it's easy to calculate, frankly, no amount of compensation is ever going to be fair to someone when you're trying to decide where should they have been free or should they have been in prison. We don't have any statute that's gone through the legislative process at this point, so we don't have the benefit of that full deliberative analysis and public policy consensus by the elected officials in Minnesota. But because I think I was a fair reference point here, so I'm going to propose that we compensate Mr. Hines in two ways. One, for the number of days he served in custody that he would not have served in custody had he been sentenced correctly in the first place. That is not interrupted by any additional conduct on his own part would result in the additional incarceration, which is to say, when he was on probation and he committed additional violations of some sort and so on, that's on him. What's on us, or I should say more particularly, what's on the parties that were involved in Mr. Hines' case, where errors occurred, is calculated now by the court administrator as 389 days, if I recall correctly. Now, I'm going to ask the chair to invite Ms. Rehak when I'm concluded here to explain her calculations both for the wrongful incarceration days and for the wage claim. The total that, and then we've got calculations also for lost compensation based on information Mr. Hines has given us, I'm comfortable are legitimately documented, financial loss claims. If this had been an ordinary tort claim, then he would have been entitled to lost wages as compensation, and he would have been entitled to perhaps some other compensation as well, in addition to compensation for mental anguish and emotional distress, which for me that $50 a day is intended to apply to because it's distinct from the wage loss component. The total loss here, by my calculation, actually by Ms. Rehak's calculation, is about $34,000, which for spending an extra year in jail is, I think, not inappropriate. Out of that, I also propose that any restitution that is still due and owing, whether it's formally covered by the Revenue Recapture Act or not, be deducted and paid directly to those parties to whom it is owed, either victims or others in the system. I would also recommend that we include a requirement that Mr. Hines sign a written release, releasing any and all claims that he would have against any of the parties involved in this wrongful incarceration. That would include the court system, judges, corrections officials, court services that was involved in the initial calculation, county attorney's office or any prosecuting authorities, and the public defender's office as well. And then in any other entities, but those specifically included, so that if Mr. Hines chooses to accept this compensation, he's giving up all claims to be able to sue the state or the political subdivisions of the state or individuals in connection with this matter, a full and final release of claims. There is one outstanding judgment against Mr. Hines related to a civil action that was obtained by the insurance company for a motor vehicle that was involved in some underlying conduct. Because Mr. Hines was incarcerated at the time that matter went to court for a default hearing, because Mr. Hines didn't show up, I do not recommend that we include any offsets for that, and that Mr. Hines have the opportunity to go assert any defenses or ability to reopen that case and defend against that civil judgment on his own. With that said, Mr. Chairman, we'll have some specific numbers after, I guess, we hear from Ms. Rehak, and I'd also suggest we hear from Mr. Hines to verify his impressions of the offsets and so on.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Lindeke.
While we were looking into how to respond to this, we had the benefit of talking with Peter Watson. And heavens, there aren't a lot of people who were here much before I was, but Peter's been here forever. He is the institutional memory of the Senate, for sure, and maybe the legislature. And he remembered back in the 70s and 60s and 50s. He wasn't here that long, but he remembered as the former claims counsel.
He researched it.
He remembered that there had been such things. Therefore, he researched it and found a number of instances, but I'll read you three of them, in which the claims commission paid people for wrongful imprisonment in the state prison. So I just wanted to mention that because this is not then unprecedented. I don't remember any like this, and we haven't done any in a long time. But for example, in 1959, they paid $7,200 to a fellow for wrongful imprisonment, $300 a month. Let's see. Leon Dodd in 1969 got $6,000 for wrongful imprisonment. And in 1971 even, a fellow named Daryl Max got $9,810 for lost wages during wrongful imprisonment. So I just wanted everybody to know that we're not actually breaking new ground here. This isn't brand new. It's happened before. We're just not one of those 22 states who has a convenient statute to deal with the problem. But the Claims Commission has dealt with it before.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lindeke. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lindeke, was 1971 the last date that was looked up by the gentleman that you...
Yes, it was.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Lindeke, Mr. Watson's research into Senator Latz's point, was there a particular framework that was employed in determining, you mentioned that there was some compensation for lost wages, you mentioned there was $300 a month, but were there particular structures that were employed in those cases, and are there any consistency between them that would be helpful?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn, all we have is these short paragraphs that describe what the compensation was for.
Okay.
By now, most of those files, I'm sure, have long since disappeared, much as our claims files do after a certain number of years.
Chair?
Senator Olsen.
That $300 a month in 1959, a shop that I worked at for many years, the old timers there were talking about in the 50s, they were making $250 an hour, and so that's really not too far off the mark at $300 a month. That's probably pretty close to what a tradesperson was making at that time.
Mr. Chair, when you look at these $7,000 or $8,000 numbers back in 1959, 1961, those are pretty big recoveries, actually.
Okay, anything further, members? Well, Ms. Rehak?
Good morning, members of the commission. My name is Judy Rehak, and I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. The question that I left the commission with last time was the question of whether or not Mr. Hines had received any credit against subsequent sentences for the time that he had spent in jail on the fleeing charge. And I reported to you, and I'm reporting on the record that I was unable to find any subsequent case in which Mr. Hines received credit for the time that he served in the DOC. So he, for all practical intents and purposes, has not used that time as credit against any other sentence.
Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Rehak. I appreciate the report, and I read through it, and I'll confess to the my colleagues on the panel and to you, this has been very difficult for me as I've read through this to get my hands around what actually happened. And I know there were a number of cases that he was convicted of and he was serving time and there was some overlapping of time, and then there are guidelines that deal with concurrent and consecutive, and some of it is permissive and some of it is required, and I tried to sort through all that. And to the point you're making just now, after his release, which as I recall was in, was it May of 08?
April of 08.
I'm sorry, April of 08. And that was the, after he had served time that technically by the guidelines he should not have served. Then he, and I'm looking at a sheet here of offense dates. There were additional offenses committed after that release date by Mr. Hines, is that correct? And then he was sentenced to serve time after those, on those offenses, and what you're saying is that none of those sentences that he received subsequent to that release that we're concerned with, he was not given any credit for those days that he served that were charged to him wrongly. Is that essentially what you're saying?
That's essentially what I'm saying. He was sentenced in those cases that were on the list, most of them. Two of them are still pending sentencing. But he was given credit for local jail time. And then the remainder of the sentence was stayed. And so he did not serve any DOC time on any of those cases, and therefore he was not given credit against any of those cases for the fleeing charge time that he served erroneously.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
And Ms. Rehak, so just as I'm looking at the list, so in April, end of April of 08, the 25th, he was... according to this, committed the offense of fleeing a police officer, felony fleeing. He was sentenced in August to 25 months, which was stayed.
Mm-hmm.
And is 4 years, is that the length of time the sentence is stayed, meaning he's on probation for that four? Okay. And then the next one down in May of 08, sentenced again in August, theft taking motor vehicle. 30 months stayed for a period of 10 years. So he's still under probation for those offenses. Is that correct?
He is.
And then in June of 08, check forgery, 120 months?
Days.
Days. Mm-hmm. And that was stayed for 245 days?
He actually served 120. That was a gross misdemeanor.
Okay.
And 245 were stayed.
And then 3 days after that was the credit card fraud felony. Now that says jury trial pending, and this is after March 15th. So is that trial taken place yet?
He's awaiting sentencing on May 20th.
And Ms. Rehak and Mr. Chairman, is that charge subject to incarceration as part of the sentence?
Well, it's a felony. It could be. I don't have a clue about what the judge will sentence him to.
And
but conceivably, he could be sentenced.
And Ms. Rehak and Mr. Chairman, if that is the case, if there is jail time that would be affiliated with that charge, Is it conceivable or likely that the judge would take the fact that he has served time into consideration that he shouldn't have served and deduct that from whatever sentence? There's also another one at the bottom, theft taking motor vehicle, that must be related because there says jury trial pending 315.
That one was dismissed.
Okay. And on the following page after that, an offense in October, driving after cancellation, court hearing pending. Now, that's a gross misdemeanor. I'm assuming there's not typically incarceration associated with that. I guess, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Rieck, what I'm trying to understand here is if Mr. Hines is still potentially facing a sentence of jail time, and if so, whether what he has served already, even though it was wrongly served, would be taken into consideration, which may have some bearing on our decision about compensation, is my point.
Ms. Rieck.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hamm, I wish I could give you a definitive answer, but I really don't know whether the judge will take it into account or not. The judge could have taken it into account on some of these earlier charges and did not. So I'm not experienced enough in criminal law sentencing to say what the likelihood is or is not in that situation.
Mr. Chairman, sir, and Ms. Rieck, so these other cases that occurred after his release, after he served the time wrongly, and the offenses that he committed following that, for which he received no jail time, I guess there was some local jail time, but no Department of Corrections time, and had the sentences stayed. Are you saying that with certainty that the judge knew about this wrongful incarceration and then use that as part of his judgment in staying the sentence, or he did not know or did not take it, or we just don't know?
I just don't know.
Okay.
Representative Olson, or Anderson, excuse me.
Johnson, Swanson. Just another Anderson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rieck, you know, in your memo, the letter to us, as claims, you mentioned in here that the State Court Administrator's Office reiterates the position, number one, that no legal obligation to compensate Mr. Hines. And I'm just wondering if you have something that you is based on what his past or his present or what may happen. Is that how they came up with the number one decision to say we have no legal obligation to reimburse him? I mean, that's what the letter is telling us, that they feel that we shouldn't have to compensate him. And I'm just asking for if you have an explanation for just that statement.
Ms. Rieck.
With very limited exceptions, judges are entitled to judicial immunity, which means they are exempt from suit. And if the judge is exempt from suit, then the state is also exempt from suit. And therefore, there is no legal immunity. There is no legal obligation to reimburse Mr. Hines for his claim.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
I'd just like to ask several of the council members, Senator Hahn or Senator Latz, about their experience in court regarding situations where you have someone like Mr. Hines who has, we know, been in jail too long, but in a situation where after being released, even after the long incarceration, it seems like the history shows that he's continually to reoffend. And it's a concern on my part, and I understand from the note that he sent in, or his first part of this packet that we have, that he is in a program now that's supposed to keep him clean and so forth and so on, and yet it seems like he's still under the auspices of having committed serious incidences that cloud the fact of what his note had to say, that he's trying to lead a clean life. And I'm not trying to be a judge here, because I'm not. I don't know. But I'm just asking from your standpoint, having dealt with in the courts and stuff, do they take that into consideration that, you know, once they've been sentenced and once they've completed their sentencing the year or whatever it is that they, and if they reoffend again, what is it likely that the courts will come back with because of the reoffending, even though they say, quote, they're trying to stay on the up and up? I'm just asking for some comments.
Senator Lyons.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, well, first of all, sentencing is entirely within the discretion of the judge, subject to certain parameters for certain kinds of convictions or offenses. The Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines grid sets forth presumptive sentences if you're convicted of certain kinds of offenses, basically felonies, and if you have certain kind of criminal histories. It accounts for both the severity level of the offense for which the person is being sentenced, and it accounts for their criminal history by adding up, you know, a calculation of the number of points they've accrued in their criminal history. In fact, that's related to what we're dealing with here today. I mean, the seam that we're dealing with in today's case is because that criminal history score point was inaccurately calculated. It was put down as a 7, but it should have been a 0 because of the permissive consecutive sentencing that was involved in Mr. Hines' case. And the difference was where you landed on the grid. Where he landed on the grid in the erroneous calculation was with a presumptive commit to state prison for 25 months. Where he should have landed on the grid was a presumptive stay of state prison time and a 1 year and 1 day sentence to the local county. And then even then, there's a whole lot more discretion on the part of the district judge to sentence. Typically, a judge will take, and a prosecutor in deciding what to ask for, will take into consideration the history, no matter what the history is, and a concern about the likelihood of reoffending in the future as well. But that's the kind of thing which is the most open for negotiation and discretion in sentencing. The thing I'm still not entirely clear on, and I'm trying to rely on the court administration now because they've got all the records, is the question of whether or not Mr. Hines in this case would have, had he been sentenced properly and upon release had committed either a new offense or some other violation of probation, would he have been subject to the additional 389 days of incarceration? So, I mean, we have a gentleman here who at the time anyway was reoffending regularly and within a week of his release on this case was reoffended with fleeing in a motor vehicle, another felony offense. And 3 weeks later was charged with theft of a motor vehicle or allegedly committed a new offense of theft of a motor vehicle. But somewhere during the course of his sentence on the underlying offense before us today, the fleeing in a motor vehicle and the second-degree DWI, he committed probation violations, which landed him back in prison. And the only thing I'm not entirely clear on is whether he would have ended up back in prison or back in jail had he been properly sentenced in the first place with the length of incarceration time and probation time. Forgive me, Ms. Rehak, if I'm throwing something at you that maybe wasn't completely factored in, or maybe you already calculated this in, but my earlier statement about not wanting to give him credit for time that he kind of brought upon himself by reoffending or violating probation upon his release, or not wanting to compensate him for the consequences of that, I guess is sort of the one somewhat open question still in my mind. Because some portion of the wrongful incarceration occurred after he had been originally released on this sentence, reoffended, and was reincarcerated as a result of the probation violations. And somewhere between October 2007 and April of 2008, And I think he was, when did he go back into prison as a result of his own conduct after he was originally released? I think October 8th, 2007.
Well, Ms. Rehak.
After October 8th of 2007, he committed and was convicted of a receipt of stolen property charge. He committed it on November 24th of 07. He was returned to the DOC, I think, on November 30th or December 1st of 07, and then was at various DOC institutions until his release in April of 08.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Rehak, for those approximately 5 months, he was in those DOC institutions as a result of probation violation, because he had not yet been convicted and sentenced on those new offenses. He wasn't until August 09.
No.
According to your chart, is that right?
Maybe I misunderstood your question. He was back in the DOC in that instance because of the violation on the fleeing charge. They revoked his supervised release on the fleeing charge.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Ms. Rehak, was that revocation based on the conduct with a Morrissey proceeding, or was that was not based on the new conviction, was it? Because he wasn't brought to trial or convicted or by trial or plea on that offense until August of 09, right?
That's correct.
So that was a Morrissey-type proceeding in which they alleged the illegal conduct as part of the probation proceedings,
yes,
right?
That's correct. So is your question, was there another offense during that period of time?
Yeah, well, the probation violation, the conduct that violated probation was also conduct that was led to a new criminal charge for which he was only later convicted and received credit for local jail time of 189 days. Okay. But as a consequence of that, he had also served additional time as a probation violation in the state prison, right?
Yes.
And so, if he had been properly sentenced initially to the year and a day, and he had, if the sentence were a year and a day, then that's the maximum that could have been executed as a year and a day, correct? Mm-hmm. And had he would have been, having served that time, upon release, he would have been discharged from probation altogether, right?
Yes, he would not have had the probation violation in November of 07.
Okay, he would have only had to face the consequences for that conduct had he then been convicted of the new crime.
That's correct.
Okay, which it turns out he was a year and a half later, and for which his sentence was the local jail credit that he had accrued in between that time.
That's correct.
Okay, so even with that analysis, the 189 days or whatever the period of time was between around December 1st, 07 and April of 08 that he served on the probation violation was wrongful in that he would not even have been on probation and subject to that additional time had he been properly sentenced in the first place.
That's correct.
Okay. All right, then I'm satisfied that that was not, that period of time is considered wrongful incarceration time. As long as he didn't get any subsequent credit for that time. We've gone over that, trying to figure out all the credit that he got from your calculations, that credit was for separately served county jail time in a variety of counties on other offenses.
That's also correct. I could find no record of him receiving separate credit for the time from November 30th through April 17th of 08 against other crimes.
Okay. So then, I think, Mr. Chair, I think then we come back to Senator Hansen. I hope I've answered Representative Anderson's question. I think then we come back to Senator Hansen's question, which has to do with sentencing on the outstanding matters that have not been resolved and whether a judge could or would give credit on those sentences for the wrongful incarceration period that we're dealing with here today. And I suppose theoretically a judge could, but I'd say it would be highly unlikely because two reasons. One is the outstanding cases were for conduct that occurred after he was released from the wrongful incarceration. And secondly, at least one of them is for conduct quite different than the stuff that led to his wrongful incarceration. I'm thinking specifically the driving after cancellation. I would assume if it's a gross misdemeanor, that's probably, and there being at least some DWI history here, that was a cancellation inimical to public safety based on a repeat DWIs, but I can't verify. There are a number of different cancellations possible. Mr. Hines could probably verify that for us. But, yeah, some judges will sentence that. Some prosecutors will actually sentence them to jail time for that. You see the practices differ depending on the circumstances. With the new ignition interlock program in effect, you get less of that, too, when people get their licenses valid. Some judges will take a look at priors and say 15 days in jail for each prior driving after withdrawal charge that's on in their history. But I think it's pretty unlikely that he would get additional credit for the wrongful incarceration period of time here.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anderson, follow up?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, I had asked both of them to respond, so I'm going to let Senator Hahn defer to Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, Representative Anderson, I don't have a lot to comment about my experience in court because I've never been in court as a defendant or as a practitioner. So I don't really have any experiential comment to make other than just trying to what we're going through here today with this thing, and I think Senator Latz's understanding of this has been helpful to me. The question I'm wrestling with a little bit here is Ms. Riak has been saying that Mr. Hines is awaiting sentencing for credit card fraud that was committed in June of 08, for which he's had a trial and there has been no sentence given. And I don't know if that would involve potential incarceration or not. I do think that, and I think it's been established here in the things that we've reviewed, that there was a wrongful sentencing, as Senator Latz has pointed out, a misidentification of the circumstances, looking at where he fell on the grid and it was incorrect. And I think it is a little bit speculative to say, well, if he'd been sentenced appropriately, would he have gotten out and I don't know. I don't want to even speculate about that. So I think it's pretty clear that he got a sentence he shouldn't have gotten. And I think there is some compensation that we should try to devise for that. However, if he has got a sentence of jail time as a result of this credit card fraud conviction, and I don't know if we as a committee could make a recommendation to the court that his time be considered in whatever sentence he is given, or we just wait to see what happens. And if the judge does take that into consideration, maybe that has a bearing on the amount of compensation that we would give him and this being the theory being that the judge has, in effect, compensated him for his wrongful time by adjusting the sentence that he has given as a result of that case. And I don't know, and I don't want to insert ourselves into a proceeding in the court, so it may not be appropriate for us to make any recommendations. But it might be useful for us to see what happens in the event that the court does decide to take his wrongful jail time as a factor in whatever sentence he gives in this instance. And if it is taken into consideration, it might have a bearing on whatever we decide to do. That would be my point.
Anything further, Representative Anderson?
The only thing I was going to ask, and I think Ms. Reak already responded to the fact that there was credit, according to what the letter from Mr. Hines says, it says, I did get credit for the time I sat from 12/14/07 to 4/17/08, totaling 125 days. That's the only thing that I was concerned about when you said that you didn't see any credit, and then Mr. Hines said he did get credit for the time of totaling 125 days. That was the only question I was looking at and wondering if there was, because she had said no credit she could find, but then I think that's all been taken care of. So thank you.
Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, Representative Anderson, what's only unclear to me in that point, and that's why I explored it with Ms. Rehak, I suspect maybe Mr. Hines knows he got credit, but wasn't familiar with the specific details of where that credit came from. Ms. Rehak has gone back over the records, and it looks like from all the sentencing transcripts, like that credit came from time served in local jails, separate and apart from the time he served in state prison wrongfully on this one. I did have a question, if Ms. Rehak knows. One of these cases that was pending on this sheet was dismissed. Which one was that?
Ms. Rehak.
The theft taking a motor vehicle without consent.
Was that the 09-4905 case number?
Yes.
Okay, because that would go back to Senator Hand's question also, because that's identical conduct, which could result in some consideration by the judge, certainly. But with that being dismissed, I'm more comfortable not worrying about that. I'd be reluctant to go back and you know, make any recommendations. Maybe the only thing we could do, if we even wanted to think about it, was indicate that Mr. Hines, if he accepts whatever this committee does in terms of compensation, not himself argue for credit in his sentencing on those subsequent offenses, if there is a sentencing, so he can't take our money and then also go try to get credit against the time he served as well. And I suppose we could put that in any kind of a release that he were to execute as a portion of accepting the compensation offered by the state for this. The only other comment I wanted to make, Mr. Chairman, was that this is a case where the wrongfulness of the incarceration is quite clear. I should say the conduct, the liability aspect of it is quite clear, where even the district court judge noted it was a clerical error on resentencing that resulted in this. So there really isn't any dispute over whether or not something wrong happened here. In fact, we could identify a number of different parties that, you know, did it wrong or missed it or didn't follow up appropriately and so on. This would be different, in my judgment, than a case where there is a legitimate legal dispute over whether, you know, the interpretation of a sentencing statute or the sentencing guidelines grid or a legal issue that was involved in the trial or the conviction or the sentencing, where reasonable minds would disagree on a dispute before the Court of Appeals and the Court of Appeals rules one way instead of the other, you know, that's a different case. In this case, we have essentially a miscalculation, which was clear, and everyone recognizes the error along the way. In terms of setting precedent, I'd want that to be recognized.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Ms. Rehak says here under the Minnesota Public Criminal History that he's used several aliases. Just wondering, how was he convicted when he received his long sentencing of 24 months instead of should have been one year and a month? Shows that he's used William Johnson, William Hines, Aaron Sakala. Are these just names that were part of the crime that he had committed at that time that these names came up, or it just says reported names on the report from past criminal history?
Ms. Rehak.
Representative Anderson, you'd do better to ask Mr. Hines that question.
Okay.
Okay. That's anything further? I'll ask Mr. Hines to come up. Microphone. Mr. Hines.
Morning.
Welcome, Mr. Hines. And identify yourself for the record.
My name is William Howard Hines.
Okay, welcome. Questions for Mr. Hines, committee?
Well, Mr.
Representative Anderson.
Regarding your criminal history, it shows here public criminal history search for William Hines, date of birth 12/7/1979. And then down underneath there, it talks about warning criminal offenders frequently use aliases, including the names of other individuals. And then the other statement made, fingerprint of verification is the only way of confirming a subject's identity. In here, there's a group of names other than your name and also middle names used with your name and with these other people's names. Just wondering under what circumstances they were used and what was the purpose. Instead, I guess, avoiding the law, my understanding.
Mr. Hines.
That is correct. Those are just names throughout the years that I have used to try to falsely identify myself because I had warrants or whatnot.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hines, we were having a discussion. I think you were overhearing that earlier with Ms. Rehak about this issue with respect to the credit card fraud, and as I understand it, that trial took place in March and that you're awaiting sentencing. Excuse me. And you've heard our discussion here a little bit about the issues surrounding that. One of the things Senator Latz talked about was trying to make sure that if we decide to compensate you for the time you spent wrongfully, that would not then also be used as a credit for if in fact this results in an imprisonment sentence. And just curious what your sense is. If you get a sentence something beyond jail time that you need to serve in that particular case, would it be more advantageous to you to have credit for time served or whatever monetary compensation that we might supply and then serve the time that would be related to that case? What you're likely to be looking at here. I don't, but do you have any comment on those things?
Yes, I do. What I am looking at is a 23-month sentence stayed over my head, put a downward departure again. This judge that is sentencing me is, in fact, the same judge that already gave me a downward departure once. So the reason why I pled to the case is because I feel, and the judge kind of feels that I'm going to get a downward departure again because of my behavior now. And he feels that I'm a good candidate for probation, as I wasn't before. And as far as the if the judge could use the fact that I've done too long in prison for this sentence, it's my understanding that he cannot, because as Senator Latz stated, that sentence ended in 2008 completely. I got out, and I didn't catch that case that I'm the credit card fraud until after the fact. So the judge, there's no way possible, could use that in his sentencing.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
And Mr. Hines, and I don't know, maybe Senator Latz knows. I'm assuming that the court could, in its discretion, do a lot. I mean, there are sentencing guidelines that require certain things, but other than that, I would assume that he or she, if they were to be aware of this, could make a determination of, based on just the court's willingness to, as you mentioned, recognize the fact that you've made changes in your life. And I don't know, but I'm just trying to get a handle on whether there is any relationship between that, what's hanging over your head, I guess, and what we're contemplating. And I guess what you're saying is that you don't think there is any relationship. Is that correct?
Quite honestly, though, the judges have no idea that I've done extra time.
Mr. Lindeke.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hines, when will the sentencing be that we're just now talking about?
Mr. Hines.
May 20th.
Okay. And Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, the money to pay Mr. Hines's claim, if we pay it, won't be available until July 1st of this year. Certainly, Ms. Rehack can check to see if he's gotten any credit for any time. And it can be written into whatever agreement is part of giving him the money.
Senator Olsey.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This might be a question for Ms. Rehack, but under the original paperwork we had, there was a list of probation fees and restitution and fines, and it totaled $42,000. And one of them was almost $34,000 for the Minnesota Correctional Institute Faribault. Can you address that, Mr.
Lindeke? Mr. Chair, we've looked into that, Senator Olsen, and that $33,000 actually doesn't have anything to do with the correctional facility at Faribault. It is a judgment by a default judgment by the State Farm Insurance Company for damage to a car involved in some earlier theft or something. And in 2005, and as Ms. Rehack pointed out when we discussed the difference between this and another judgment that has been docketed, State Farm, it was a default judgment. Mr. Hines didn't have an opportunity to respond to the $33,000 judgment, didn't go to court. He was in jail at the time, is what I understand. And so they haven't docketed that judgment and have apparently made no attempt to collect it. It would be up to them and Mr. Hines to deal with that $33,000 on their own. That's our understanding.
Mr. Chair, a follow-up? Do we have a list then of the total restitution and fines or to make victims whole?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, the other $8,000 or whatever it is, I can't remember the exact number on that list, Mr. Hines has agreed should be paid to those people for those things, including library fines in the prison or something, whatever it is that's on there. The rest of it he's agreed is valid and should be taken out of whatever settlement there is here. That's my understanding.
Okay, anything further,
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, maybe Ms. Rehak can clarify this along the lines of Senator Olsen's question. But the list that was in our packet had fines and restitution, judgment, probation fees, balances as of April 1, 2010. And that does have the almost $34,000 restitution matter. Why does it say restitution MCF Faribault on that list?
Ms. Rehak.
Senator Latz, in checking with the DOC and the several institutions about what outstanding fines and fees there might be, I received information about this claim, and I assumed that it was restitution. That was an error on my part. When I checked the case file, it is not docketed as a restitution judgment. So it is, unfortunately, an error on my part.
So, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Rehak, the underlying criminal case that was connected to that civil action, was that dismissed?
Yes, it was.
Okay, so what was left then was a civil claim by the insurance company for a vehicle that was damaged in connection with conduct relating to Mr. Hines. And there was some dispute over whose fault was the damage. And Mr. Hines was not able to be part of the proceedings determining that liability because he was incarcerated?
It was docketed as a default judgment. And okay. That means that he did not appear. He was in prison at the time that it was presented to the court for docketing.
Okay. And maybe Mr. Hines, was there some question as to who was driving the vehicle? Is that it, or who?
Mr. Hines.
That is correct. I wasn't driving the vehicle, and I was trying to fight it from prison, but it was very difficult to do, given the circumstances. So,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, there's a civil liability dispute going on here, unrelated to any criminal conviction, and he may have trouble getting he probably can get the default judgment reopened, but that'll be up to a district court judge to analyze his request to do that, and if so, he'll have his day in court to sort that out. But because there are no criminal matters pending in connection with that, I guess my preference would be just to let that take its own course in the civil proceedings.
Well, then, Mr. Chair and members, one thing that, because it's interesting reading, this Supreme Court letter that we got from Ms. Dozier, I believe it was, saying that they didn't feel there was any responsibility, and if we open this up with restitution, it'll be a can of worms, and everything that we, every case that's reopened in that will be before us to claims. But I personally feel that not we, but in the state system, Mr. Hines has been injured by a sentence that was longer than what the guidelines called for. And I actually talked to him after the last meeting, and what he expressed to me was that, like Mr. Lenneke said, that he would be willing to clean up the slate, basically, so that he would move forward, without having to pay restitution on these other claims except for this car claim with Allstate, I guess. I'm wondering if, if we're thinking of a number, we use this $8,500, which is approximately the difference between the $42,000 and the $34,000 as a base number, and then some money for lost wages and stuff in there. That other chart we showed about a $21,000, that one right there, that $21,000, how does ever the other members feel about it? That is our settlement number.
Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, I think before you came in, I kind of described what I was going to recommend in terms of the basis for this, basically using the Iowa statutes that address wrongful convictions as a reference point. which was $50 a day for the wrongful incarceration period, plus lost wages, up to a cap of $25,000, which is the way the Iowa statute reads. And using that calculation, there would be a total of $19,450 for the daily rate compensation, the 389 days times $50 a day. There would be compensation for lost wages. I don't have the exact number here in this email, but the total of the grant would be $34,049.10. Whatever that is, less than $19,450 would be the lost wages component of the award, and then from that, $8,565.10 would be deducted for fines and restitution due and owing, whether or not formally covered by the Revenue Recapture Act, and then accompanying that would be a complete release of claims by Mr. Hines against the state, political subdivisions, or individuals that were involved in the process here, resulting in a compensation by the state to him that I guess he agreed not to use the fact of any wrongful incarceration for which he is compensated as a basis for claiming or seeking a reduction in any executed or other sentence for subsequent offenses here.
I mean, that
I'll make a motion to that effect.
Senator Olsey. Well, first of all, Senator Letts has made that a motion. Senator Olsey.
I'll second that. We don't need to in this committee, do we?
Well, and Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to add on to that, Mr. Heineke, just the point you were making about the timing of any restitution or any payment that we would make would be after the sentencing. Do we want to tie the restitution to that timing? In other words, to say that we would. The claim wouldn't be paid until after the sentencing, and under certain circumstances, the claim may be adjusted. Is that what you were thinking?
Mr. Lenneke.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, that is what I was thinking. I'm pretty sure we won't be paying it until after the sentencing is done, but it should be subject to revisiting the amount. If we find out from Ms. Rehack that there was credit given for this time.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess maybe we could modify, if Senator Latz is willing, his motion to reflect that sense that we have, that whatever the court may do, if it does have a bearing on this, that we take that in consideration.
Mr. Chairman, I'll add to my motion, it's a great suggestion, that Mr. Hines submit to the, I suppose to the staff of the claims committee and or Ms. Rehack, a copy of the sentencing proceedings in any pending offenses, and that it be verified that the court did not grant any credit for the period of wrongful incarceration in connection with that, and that Mr. Hines did not seek credit for that, and assuming then there's no further offset, that the amount that's approved by the commission today be distributed to Mr. Hines, and that if there is some credit granted for any of the wrongful incarceration period, then that amount of credit be calculated at $50 a day and deducted from the compensation amount that we're granting, and that that would be a part of the legislation that we have proposed to pass this session.
All right, Senator Letts just modified his motion to the description he just gave. Anything further? Representative Anderson.
I don't want to have to say. I guess I asked the question for Senator Latz is the total amount, just to reiterate the total amount that you're asking.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, $34,049.10 would be the compensation amount. From that, $8,565.10 would be deducted for distribution for fines and restitution and fees and so on. That would be subject to the Revenue Recapture Act or otherwise due and owing to the state, political subdivisions, or victims. And then the balance distributed to Mr. Hines, subject to the last provision that he not
on
getting
sentence.
Any additional credit after sentencing. After sentencing.
After sentencing.
So even if sentencing gets delayed, I guess I would say let's get that sentencing transcript in to verify that there's no credit given for this, the days here. And then distribution could occur.
Thank you.
Mr. Lindeke.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Hines, as I understand it, and Senator Olsen mentioned it also in his conversation with you after our last meeting, you have been paying some of these amounts off gradually over time, the amounts that you owe of this $7,000 or $8,000. So that I just want to would hope that if he has paid some more, that we will only take out of the amount that he then owes at whatever time we give him his payment.
Mr. Chairman, I'll modify my my motion to reflect that as
what
well.
What a motion.
Okay, Senator.
I hope someone's keeping track of this.
Senator Latz modified his motion again.
Okay.
Senator Olsen.
The only comment, I really appreciate the work Senator Latz has done on this, but so this, Ms. Dozel from the state court administrator, I want to read this sentence. Should the claims commission choose to reimburse persons whose decisions are amended or reversed in the appellate process, it will be opening the door for numerous claims, costly investigations, and disputes about damages which the law has resolved through the specified procedure. Because we've heard that, you know, in their letter, they list the number of times that are in our packet, how this happens on an annual basis. There's a certain number. But if you go back to 1972, there's been mistakes made for 30-some, almost 40 years, yet I don't see people running to the claims committee for reimbursement. You know, I don't think if we do this, the floodgates are going to open. And maybe that's the question I have, is if we do this, will the floodgates open and will be hard to based on the past history, I don't see that happening.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, I, you know, one or two of these cases in several years, the floodgates are not likely to open on this. But the other factor is that I believe Senator Latz intends, he can speak for himself, to draft some legislation so that we will be the 23rd state to have some kind of solution to this kind of problem in the statutes, a systemic resolution of this problem. I hope that's what's going to happen.
Okay, anything else, committee members?
And where's the money coming from?
Mr. Lindeke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the money would come from the general fund. Mr. Chair, Senator Representative Murphy, I have checked with Bill Marks. He says that he set aside $100,000 for the claims bill, even though I told him earlier it was going to be quite a bit less. So there is ostensibly in the budget somewhere money available if we should have to pay this.
Yeah.
Okay, anything further, committee? Mr. Hines? No. Okay, the motion is before us. If there's nothing further, we'll vote. All in favor of the Latz motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
The motion carries.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Lindeke.
I'm going to spend some time with Senator Latz to make sure exactly what that motion was all about because it's been amended so many times.
Do we need another committee meeting?
Mr. Lindeke, it's all on the tape. It may take a while to separate it out. Thank you.
It's only been 2 hours. I shouldn't say 1 hour.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, we're to injury claims on the agenda.
All right. Well, Mr. Chair, I have them in my packet divided into several groups. I have some new ones that we didn't have at the last subcommittee meeting where the department has recommended payment for certain permanent partial disabilities. And then there are a couple of them that the department has recommended that we hold over until full recovery. And then there are a couple that there is apparently no permanent partial disability. So should we start? I don't know what's up to you. Should we start with the ones where it's recommended that we pay some amount?
Yeah, Mr. Lindeke, I believe that's a good idea, and if you can let the committee know which ones those
are. All right. The first of those I have on my pile is Leon Hetfer at Minnesota Correctional Facility at Faribault. He was injured on April 9th of last year. The end of his left ring finger was smashed and removed. It was partially amputated at the midpoint of the distal phalange. I guess that's Mr. Hartnett could explain where that is.
Mr. Hartnett.
He was assembling metal beds when one of them fell and cut off the tip. There is a picture of it right there, the second page. The recommendation is, because it's a 2.5% permanent partial disability, that we pay $1,875, and that's subject to the Revenue Recapture Act.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Lyons.
Just a thought, as we could go over these individually, or as we sometimes have done in the past, where there isn't any real dispute and everyone, the department is recommending payment just in the ordinary course of of the proceedings, that we could maybe bunch those together rather than going through a description of each case.
All right. Mr. Chair, the next...
No objection from the committee. We'll move forward.
The next one is William Jones, 5% permanent partial disability, $3,750. The third one is John Lee at Faribault, 4.93% permanent partial disability, $3,703.13. And those are the three that I have where the recommendation is that we pay.
So moved.
Okay, the Senator Letts has moved payment on those three. The Hetfer, the Leon Hetfer, William Jones, and John Lee claims. Anything further? Any discussion to the motion? Okay. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, there are two where it's recommended that we hold them over until we see what full recovery is in each of these cases and whether there is a permanent partial disability. One of them is Aaron Osten, and the other is Donald Bradley. One of them we hold over until May of this year, which isn't very long.
Mr. Okay. Chairman, I move that we hold those two cases over.
Okay. Senator Letts has moved we hold over the Aaron Osten and Donald Bradley injury claims. Any discussion to the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Mr. Lindeke.
Mr. Chair, the next one is a little bit more complicated. I have it in my packet here. It's Wade Murphy. Wade Murphy was a sentencing to service performer in Hennepin County when the driver of the Hennepin County van in which he was riding rear-ended a car in front of him, and Mr. Murphy was injured. And there's no permanent partial disability here, but there is an amount of $119.74 that is owed to a chiropractor for medical services performed to him. And That's from the total chiropractor bill of $1,335, apparently at the medical assistance rate. $1,335 becomes $119. There's been a, you'll see the letters back and forth and back and forth in here from Mr. Hartnett to Hennepin County saying they're self-insured, they ought to be paying this. Hennepin County saying that the statute says that the claims subcommittee only reduces these by any proceeds received by the claimant or the medical care provider from any insurance policy covering the loss. And neither party apparently is willing to pay this one. The chiropractor is unpaid as a result. Now, this brings to mind two other claims I've seen since I've been on the subcommittee.
All right. Mr. Chairman?
Senator Lyons.
I'm going to move that we pay the chiropractor the $119 in some sense, subject to the department seeking reimbursement from us if the department determines that is later appropriate. And I would also ask Mr. Lindeke to propose at a later time some an amendment to the statute to clarify this so we can resolve that dispute for future cases.
Good idea.
Okay. Any discussion to the Latz motion?
Let me just ask one question, if you don't mind. I would prefer, rather than putting this in the bill and having us appropriate money for it, that we direct Mr. Hartnett to pay, because he has the ability to pay claims under $500 for STS work.
So moved.
Mr. Hartnett.
Mr. Chair, the one comment I wanted to make is certainly when looking at this particular case, it's a very low-valued case. We do, however, have three pending claims from Hennepin County involving accidents with their drivers. My concern is that if this subcommittee starts taking the no-fault insurance coverage for these medical care cases and taking that out of the statute, that we'll end up paying those things, and the matters will be resolved through this process rather than through the no-fault process, which is going to involve the insurance of other drivers as well. In this particular case, this accident occurred because another individual driver stopped short and the Hennepin County van back-ended, it's my understanding. Additionally, the claimant in this case had been in another car accident prior to the STS incident. I think it was approximately 2 days earlier, and we don't have any way to sort those things out. Again, because this is a small case, it doesn't make that much difference, but these cases can become very complex and very expensive, and I wanted the subcommittee to be aware that there's a tail with this. It's my position, certainly, that the no-fault insurance ought to be covering this. That's what we do when we have a car accident with one of our folks, is we give it to state risk management under the no-fault plan.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
My understanding then would be that you would prefer that we paid it and that you guys would seek, or the state administration would seek restitution?
Senator Olson, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, when we currently have a car accident involving one of our transportation vehicles, it might be because in the past we've taken what we call special duty, i.e. trips to medical care as being an assigned duty, but what we have done, we have an offender who is claiming injury on that. That matter was referred to the state risk management office for our own self-insured coverage under the no-fault laws, because what's involved in that case is not only the injury to the offender, but the actions of other drivers and comparative fault and that sort of thing. And that has been my practice, at least in the last 10 years, is to try and take these auto accident cases out of this process, because the no-fault insurance law covers medical care. In this particular case, because this was a Hennepin County driver, I believe that Hennepin County's admittedly self-insured no-fault program ought to be covering it.
Senator Lentz.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure the well over $119 worth of state employee or local employee time has been spent on this matter. So that's why I think we need a statutory clarification, and when we do that process, we can certainly include some provision to seek reimbursement from Hennepin County's no fault in this particular case as well if we think it's appropriate. But I say let's just get rid of it at this point and then try to fix the statute so we get rid of the disputes in the future as well.
Further discussion, committee? Okay, on the motion. All in favor of the Latz motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, the next, I have four more of these. The next one on my pile is Vernon Olson. We've dealt with him a couple of times in the past, in prior years, including November of 08 and whatever. We've dealt with him before, and he apparently was going to submit some medical information from his doctor about his permanent partial disability. He was injured in 07. My understanding is that we haven't gotten any information from his doctor, or that we have, but is it in here?
Yes.
I couldn't find it. So in any event, the doctor has said that his injury was not related to lifting this buffer, that his permanent partial disability is not caused by lifting the buffer, and he has chosen not to come down and testify on this, and I gather that his lawyer, who once offered this as a $40,000 settlement on this or something, has backed out and is no longer requiring a payment. That's my understanding of this one. Is that your understanding, Randy?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, I have not heard from either Mr. Olson or his counsel since the treating physician sent the letter agreeing with the independent medical examiner's findings.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To staff, is it the Crohn Clinic or is it the Northern Orthopedics letter note that's in the packet here that is the one we're referencing, Mr. Lindeke is referencing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I believe it is the Northern Orthopedics that's the treating physician for Mr. Olson.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
I would move to deny the Olson claim.
Okay, discussion to the Olson motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, the final three claims are Joe Martin Pruano, who has a scar but no loss of function on his finger. Apparently a scar so small that it's below 1 centimeter or whatever the amount is that you get money, whereas if it's smaller than that, you don't. A claimant twisted his ankle during basketball game. That's Cecil Smith. There could be other reasons for his pain. There is no rateable permanent partial disability. And finally, Richard Johnson, who got his thumb crushed in a pneumatic clamp. And I just want to ask Mr. Hartnett, so you lose your thumbnail and there's no permanent partial disability? And yet, if you only have a centimeter, 1.1 centimeter scar or something on the tip of your finger, you do get money?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, that's the way the disability schedule is written. It talks about isolated tissue loss exceeding 1 centimeter at the tip of the, if you'll excuse me from using the medical term, the distal phalange.
Oh, yeah.
The phalangele is simply a knuckle.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
I would move to deny the Smith and the Perno claims. I'm not moving on the Johnson one on this one.
Okay. To the Olson motion to deny the Perno and Smith claims. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Okay, we're still on the Richard Johnson case.
So, you, Mr. Hartnett, you did say that 1.1 centimeter would get you some money on your finger, but a thumbnail, that just seems awful. A thumbnail is no permanent partial disability if you never have your thumbnail again?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, I simply can't find that in the permanent partial disability schedule. I can only speculate as to what the folks that put that together were thinking, but if we're talking about loss of function, a shortening of the finger is going to result in the loss of the function of that finger, whereas the fingernail, which doesn't serve as much of a functional capacity for that finger, I'm simply quoting what the disability schedule says. There's nothing in there for loss of a fingernail. I don't know if all losses of fingernail are permanent either.
Central thing.
I just have a question because it says they picked up the thumbnail at the machine and was there an attempt? I didn't read in the other stuff if there was an attempt to attach it or reattach it or.
Not that I'm aware of, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Letts.
I move that we deny the Richard Johnson claim.
To the Letts motion to deny the Richard Johnson claim. Discussion. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Lindeke.
As far as I know, that's all the claims for today. I want to let the two chairs know that as soon as possible today, I'll be working on our delete everything amendment and that you should both start asking for hearings at the appropriate finance committees. And yes,
Mr. Chair, thought we had one more case.
I don't
on
have.
The docket.
I don't have that here. Okay.
And that's the matter of
Kent Jones.
Okay. And this is a very large file. Mr. Jones submitted approximately 100 pages of material, but I think a fair analysis of it indicates that it boils down to one particular question. Mr. Jones was working in a program at Stillwater called the PI program, which is a federal program which permits prisoners to produce goods that are sold in interstate commerce but subject to federal rules. The difference between the PI program and most of our other work programs is that those individuals begin making minimum wage and get raises like they would if they were working in the community. Mr. Jones, I believe at the time of his injury, was making $7 an hour. Yes, Mr. Lindy.
Mr. Chair. I recall this claim now because it's the one I read most recently. I only got it a couple days ago, end of last week, and so I particularly this PI program and the wage loss that he's putting in for, I think is going to require more research. I wouldn't deny that claim for wage loss yet. And as for the rest of it, I believe Mr. Hartnett is recommending that we wait till later to see what the full permanent partial disability is. So on this claim, I think the proper procedure at this point would be like those other two, to hold it over until we see what the permanent partial disability is and until I can do some further research and discussion with Mr. Hartnett about what this wage loss thing is, how this affects the federal government's involvement in the PI program if we don't pay him for some of this wage loss and stuff like that.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, I believe is fine. I just want the subcommittee to know that the PI program is up for recertification, and they have asked us if there has been any change in the statutory scheme we have for compensating on these claims, and of course at this point there has not, but we were working under an approval from them dating from 2005, where they did examine this claims process.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I move that we hold over the Kent Jones case for further investigation, and we hear it at a later date.
Okay. Centralized with a different subject.
No, that's what I was going to do.
Okay. To the Anderson motion, any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Okay, there. Mr. Lindeke, is that finished up?
Now I think we're finished.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, we're ready to adjourn. Anything further, members, before I adjourn? Okay, we're adjourned.